welcome to On Science. I'm Alison Richards, NPR's science editor. Twins come in twos, and this week we have two lots of research involving twins. Then there's climate change, and the curious fact that fewer and fewer Americans believe it's happening. What's going on there? We also ask the question, is burning natural gas rather than coal going to help stop global warming? And to finish, we have the minuscule diet of the mega fish. But first, climate change. It seems Americans are growing more sceptical that climate change is really happening. According to recent polls, the number of Americans who believe that humans are making the planet dangerously warmer is going down. And that's despite a raft of scientific reports that say otherwise. That puzzles many climate scientists, but not social scientists. Christopher Joyce reports.
The divide between climate believers and disbelievers can be as wide as a West Virginia valley, and that's where two of them squared off recently at a public debate on West Virginia Public Radio. Coal company president Don Blankenship is a doubter.
It's a hoax because it clearly anyone that says that they know what the temperature is going to of the earth's going to be in 2020 or 2030 needs to be put in an asylum because they don't.
On the other side, environmentalist Robert Kennedy Jr.
98% of the research climatologists in the world say that global warming is real, that its impact's going to be catastrophic. There are 2% who disagree with that. I have a choice of believing the 98% or the 2%.
For a social scientist and lawyer Don Brayman, it's not surprising that two people can disagree so strongly over science. Brayman is on the faculty at George Washington University and a part of a research group called Cultural Cognition.
People tend to conform their factual beliefs to ones that are consistent with their cultural outlook, their worldview.
Brayman's group has conducted several experiments to back that up. First, they ask people to describe their cultural beliefs. Some embrace new technology, authority, and free enterprise, the so-called individualistic group. Others are suspicious of authority or of commerce and industry. Brayman calls them communitarians. In one experiment, Brayman then queried his subjects about something unfamiliar, nanotechnology, new research into tiny molecule-sized objects that could lead to novel products.
These two groups start to polarize as soon as you start to describe some of the potential benefits and harms.
The individualists tended to like nanotechnology. The communitarians generally viewed it as dangerous, all based on the same information.
It doesn't matter whether you show them negative or positive information. They reject the information that is contrary to what they would like to believe, and they glom onto the positive information.
So what's going on here?
Basically, the reason that people react in a closed-minded way to information is that the implications of it threaten their values.
That's Dan Kahan, a law professor at Yale University and a member of Cultural Cognition. He says people test new information against their pre-existing view of how the world should work.
If the implication, the outcome, can affirm your values, you think about it in a much more open-minded way.
And if the information doesn't, you tend to reject it. In another experiment, people read a United Nations study about the dangers of global warming. Then the researcher said, okay, the solution is to regulate pollution from industry. Many in the individualistic group then rejected the climate science. But when more nuclear power was offered as the solution,
they said, you know, it turns out global warming is a serious problem.
And for the communitarians, climate danger seemed less serious if the only solution was more nuclear power. Then there's the messenger effect. In an experiment dealing with the dangers versus benefits of a vaccine, the scientific information came from several people. They ranged from a rumpled and bearded expert to a crisply businesslike one, and people tended to believe the message that came from the person they considered to be more like them. Which brings us back to climate.
If you have people who are skeptical of the data on climate change, you can bet that Al Gore is not going to convince them at this point.
So, should climate scientists hire, say, Newt Gingrich as their spokesman? Dan Kahan says no.
The goal can't be to create a kind of psychological house of mirrors so that people end up seeing exactly what you want. The goal has to be to create an environment that allows them to be open-minded.
And Kahan says you can't do that just by publishing more scientific data. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
of the big energy companies, like ExxonMobil, are betting that natural gas will provide a lot more of the country's electricity in the future. Natural gas is becoming increasingly affordable. From New York to Texas, more companies are extracting gas from enormous shale rock formations. Making electricity from natural gas also produces only half the greenhouse gases that coal does, which is why some national environmental groups have started pushing it as a climate fix. But as NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, it's sparking friction with some of their local members.
The Sierra Club's internal dispute over natural gas flared up recently at Cornell University. During a ribbon-cutting ceremony and tour of a plant that will help Cornell switch from coal to natural gas.
We're going to walk into the heating plant.
Sierra Club's Bruce Nillis came all the way from Washington to cheer Cornell on. He heads the group's fight against coal, and he's gung-ho about natural gas as a remedy to climate change.
Natural gas is going to play a critical role in our energy mix for the next 2 to 3, if not 4, decades.
Nillis believes part of the solution lies right under Cornell University and much of western New York, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, the giant Marcellus shale gas field.
We are for development, but it's got to be done right and allow us to get off of coal in the next 2 decades.
That's all well and good, but also one of the Sierra Club's priorities is about clean water.
Kate Bartholomew is the volunteer chair of Sierra Club's local chapter in New York's Finger Lakes region. She's a high school biology teacher, and she's worried that this area's fabulous lakes and drinking wells will be poisoned by chemical-laced water pumped underground by drilling companies. She says she confronted Nillis about this during a breakfast before the tour.
Bruce and I had a little bit of a tense moment.
The Sierra Club's whole New York State chapter is fighting to keep Marcellus gas underground in direct opposition to the national group's policy. Bartholomew says the state activists were spurred into action when they saw pictures of shale gas developments elsewhere in the country.
It was like these huge pimples all over the place with, you know, barely any space between the drill pads.
Not what she wants to see in the Finger Lakes, a bucolic area with lots of forests where she likes to hike and cross-country ski.
I don't want to walk out and see 5-acre drill pads all over my hillside. Yeah, and I don't want my water to be contaminated.
Bartholomew isn't leaving the Sierra Club, but she's upset about its boosterism for natural gas. The group's executive director, Carl Pope, says she's got lots of company.
Well, it has caused friction, and it's going to cause friction.
Pope says the Sierra Club's leadership decided it had to come up with a practical prescription for how the country could slash greenhouse gas emissions.
There are people who don't agree with the policy because they think the Sierra Club's role should just be to oppose anything that has any environmental consequences. They don't think our role should be to say, okay, here's where we think we should get our energy.
Pope says creating electricity from natural gas creates much less of the air pollution that makes people sick than coal does, and drilling for natural gas doesn't damage the land nearly as much as mountaintop coal mining has in Appalachia. It's destroyed peaks, forests, and streams there. That's why the Sierra Club is promoting natural gas.
We see it as the cleanest of the fossil fuels.
He's not surprised by the reaction of Sierra Club members who live above the Marcellus field.
What's happening with the new discoveries of natural gas is that parts of the country that historically didn't pay any environmental bill for energy production because they didn't produce energy are going to start paying a bigger share of the bill, and people don't like that.
Pope says that's understandable, especially when the development is happening in their backyards. As for Kate Bartholomew, she says she weeps for Appalachia. But her focus is her local environment, so she'll do everything in her power to persuade Pope and the rest of the Sierra Club to help her keep energy development away from her beloved Finger Lakes. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
Now to those twins. Scientists are reporting a new explanation for why identical twins aren't exactly identical. They already knew that external forces like diet and exercise could explain some of the differences, but scientists suspected something else was going on. Now they think they know what it is. Joe Palka has the story.
Before we get to the really cool stuff involving worms, let's talk a little bit about people.
If you look in identical twins, how different are identical twins?
That's Arjun Raj. He's a molecular biologist at the University of Pennsylvania. He says the differences aren't great, but since they have the same genes, there must be something else going on. To systematically study that something else, you'd want to rear twins in identical circumstances for the first 20 or so years of their lives. Same diet, same time on the treadmill, so you could eliminate the external forces that might be causing the differences. Well, you know as well as Arjun Raj does that raising humans in captivity is frowned upon. So he decided to study genetically identical worms.
Think of them like identical twins.
He reared his worms in the same petri dishes with the same food, yet they didn't all grow up the same.
Some fraction of them will look one way and some fraction of them will look a different way, even though they're really identical.
So what's going on here? Raj thinks the answer is how genes express themselves. When scientists talk about gene expression, they mean, is the gene turned on? Raj figured out a neat way to watch genes turn on and off. When a gene expresses itself, it makes a molecule called messenger RNA in various spots in the developing worm.
We have a really nice method for actually counting individual molecules by fluorescence imaging, so you can actually see these individual little spots of messenger RNAs. And by counting those spots, we get a really accurate estimate of how much expression there is.
So he studied one particular gene and measured how it was expressing itself as worms grew from embryo to adult. And even though the DNA in these worms was all identical, the gene expression was not.
We think that this variability is stochastic.
Stochastic. Big word, but all it means is the variability is random. No specific reason for it. Just random. In this particular case, the results of this variation is some worms developed normally and some didn't. So coming back to boring old humans, some of the reason identical twins aren't exactly alike may be because of these random fluctuations in gene expression. But wait a minute. If all these genes are expressing themselves differently as we grow from embryo to adult, how come most of the time we develop normally? University of California San Diego biologist Scott Rifkin says that's a good question.
You have all these things that can go wrong. You have all this genetic variation. You have all these fluctuating environments, and yet it works. You know, you don't see people going out there with third arms growing out of their chest.
Rifkin was Raj's co-author in the worm study that is published in today's edition of the journal Nature. Now, there's one thing I haven't told you about the worm experiment. These were mutant worms engineered to reveal the gene expression fluctuations. Adrian Streit is a biologist at the Max Planck Institute in Tübingen, Germany. He says you don't see this variability most of the time because there's a lot of redundancies in the system, multiple genetic pathways that can get the same result.
Basically, by having two or three things that do the same, even if one of them might not be right 100% of the time, if you have two or three that do it, it's very, very unlikely that all of them fail.
And that built-in redundancy comes to us courtesy of evolution. Scott Rifkin says natural selection weeded out the creatures that didn't work out reliable systems to make sure arms and legs and kidneys all show up in the right places.
The ones that didn't work, well, they didn't pass on their genes. They didn't pass on the whole developmental process to their offspring because they didn't have any offspring. They didn't work.
So celebrate our differences, but be glad evolution gave us backup systems so we mostly look the same. Opalka, NPR News, Washington.
One of these things is not like the others. Which one is different? Do you know? Can you tell which thing is not like the others? I'll tell you if it is so.
Another story this past week also studied twins. The aim this time was to try and find out whether being good or bad at recognizing faces is determined by our genes. John Hamilton talked to some researchers to find out.
People are wired to pay attention to faces pretty much from birth. Jeremy Wilmer, a psychologist at Wellesley College, says that's clear from experiments that put things like a circle, a square, and a drawing of a face in front of a baby who is only a few days old.
The baby will spend a lot of time looking at the face relative to the other things. In fact, if you give a baby a right-side-up face and an upside-down face, it will prefer the right-side-up face.
But this early interest in faces doesn't necessarily mean we're good at remembering them when we grow up. Wilmer says some people struggle to recognize faces, while other people qualify as super recognizers.
I have a very good friend who's a school teacher who often will refrain from saying hello, John, because she might have only met them 6 years ago on the subway, and she likes to avoid creeping these people out.
Wilmer and his colleagues wanted to know to what extent the ability to recognize faces is influenced by our genes. So he compared hundreds of fraternal twins, who share only half their genes, with hundreds of identical twins, who share all their genes. All the twins took a test that involves memorizing 6 faces. Then participants are shown 3 more faces, 2 unfamiliar and 1 from the group they've memorized.
And they have to say, which one of these 3 is one of the ones I was supposed to remember?
Wilmer says the ability of a pair of non-identical twins to recognize faces often differed quite a bit. But that wasn't the case with twins who were identical.
We found that identical twins are extraordinarily similar to each other, evidence that face recognition ability is a highly familial trait.
Wilmer's team also wanted to know whether recognizing faces was a separate skill or just an aspect of a broader ability to remember things. So they tested several thousand people via an internet site on a range of recognition and memory skills.
Those who were good at face recognition ability were not necessarily good at verbal ability and were not necessarily good at abstract art memory.
All of this supports the idea that there is some part of the brain that specializes in processing faces. Nancy Kanwisher, a brain scientist at MIT, says the most likely candidate is a place her lab has named the fusiform face area.
Just behind and underneath and in a bit from your right ear.
Kanwisher says it makes sense that genes would include special code for such an area because faces are so important to us.
They tell you not just who that person is, but what kind of mood they're in, whether they're male or female, how old they are, you know, what they are looking at. Are they looking at you or something else? There's all this rich visual information you can get from a brief glimpse at a face.
Kanwisher says face recognition appears to be so basic that people don't even need to learn it the way we learn language. Kanwisher says Japanese researchers provided strong evidence of this in an experiment with monkeys. The researchers spent years raising monkeys who never saw faces, human or monkey. The animals were separated from other monkeys, and their human caretakers wore masks. Even so, Kanwisher says,
these monkeys had adult-like face discrimination abilities on the very first session that they were ever tested on faces.
Probably thanks to their genes. Wilmer's study appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Now it's time to cast your mind back to a world when there were no faces to recognize. During the age of dinosaurs, the oceans were filled with fierce marine reptiles. And like the terrible lizard on land, these toothy giants swam around snapping up their prey. But a new study suggests that's rather a one-sided picture. It turns out there were plenty of gentle giants too. Large fish that got their dinner much like today's whales, by slurping in water and filtering out tiny sea creatures. Noel Greenfield Boyce reports.
Matt Friedman studies fossilized fish at the University of Oxford. A few years ago, he was out doing some research at the Rocky Mountain Dinosaur Resource Center in Colorado. And while he was there, some workers were preparing the fossil of what was thought to be a kind of giant predatory swordfish based on its distinctive fins.
They got their set of fins as they had expected, and then they got a series of kind of oddly shaped plates and a bunch of rod-like bones, sort of bits and pieces of bone that they couldn't really make head or tail of.
They called Friedman over and said, hey, you're a fossil fish guy. Take a look at these weird bones.
Then the penny dropped, and I sort of realized what this thing was.
The unusual bones looked like structures for gulping in water and taking out little bits of food. He realized that this fish was a filter feeder, and that was really surprising.
Because we had known that there were fish that did this for a living, sort of got to very big sizes and filter fed. But we thought that they were limited to a very, very short period in the fossil record, that they were maybe around for 20 million years.
The fossils he was looking at in Colorado were 80 million years younger.
And so that immediately suggested that these animals had a much longer evolutionary history than we ever thought.
He wondered how many other fish like this lived back then. He decided to look for other fossil specimens that might have been missed.
Many museums have drawers labeled basically undetermined fish remains or things like this.
And when he searched those drawers for filter feeders, he found them. For example, he went through one collection in London.
In the course of an afternoon at the museum there, I found three additional examples of these animals.
In the journal Science, Friedman and his colleagues report that big, filter-feeding fish swam the seas for more than 100 million years. This casts a new light on the oceans during the time of the dinosaurs.
You can sort of flip into sort of children's books of prehistoric life, and you see these sort of vignettes from deep time of these, you know, scary marine reptiles doing horrible things to each other. But what you're missing are kind of these giant animals that are filter-feeding, eating plankton.
Until they died off during the same event that killed the dinosaurs.
And then soon after, you have the first appearance of all these modern groups of filter feeders. Your first manta rays, your first whale sharks, your first basking sharks, and then later on your first whales, after this group of giant filter-feeding fishes goes extinct.
The discoveries have impressed Nick Pyonson. He's a whale paleontologist with the Smithsonian Institution.
As a paleontologist, I'm always looking forward to being surprised by what we know about the fossil record. So this is really welcome news.
He says this news solves a long-standing mystery. Today's oceans have all these large filter feeders, and scientists had been puzzled by the fact that similar creatures were missing from the early fossil record.
The fact that we didn't see suspension feeding filter feeders was really kind of a big question mark. Where were all these guys?
He says we now know they were there. Just overlooked. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And that's all for On Science. If you'd like to hear and read more stories, you can visit our website, npr.org/science. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Alison Richards.